Railroad centers always occupy a very special place in the heart of any town. The commercial life around them that grew, the vitality of the hustle and bustle of the depot. Bob Cotter is going to share with us life around the junction. I am interviewing him at 183 Haywood Mill Road, his home, on September 9th, 1992. Mr. Cotter is 70 years old. What can you tell us about life at the depot and around the junction?
Well, if I may borrow from Barry Higgins, I would like to say that this presentation is junketing around the depots, plural. The time frame is around 1920 to 1942. At that time, there were two depots, the Concord Junction Depot and the one named Reformatory, the central division of the Boston and Maine Railroad, located in the Barrett's Mill Road area. And I hope to answer a couple of questions. What is missing and what is new? I've chosen to begin on Highland Street, where I lived from September 1922 to October 1956. Ralph Warner, the owner of the land, laid out his plan for house lots on Highland Street and the north side of Main Street, budding Highland Street in 1896. My parents moved there, as I said, in September 1922 from 200 Commonwealth Avenue, which was in the fork of the, quote, Harvard Road, unquote, and the Air Road. A gasoline station and garage set in the V of the fork, and our house was behind it. This is the first item of what is missing. That both the house and the garage have been removed and a new gas station has been installed. Not far from this location on Barrett's Mill Road was the Reformatory Railroad Station. One of the station agents was Mr. Layton, Marguerite Layton's father. The tracks entered what is now the Reformatory Rotary and swung behind the present parking lot at the end of the White Road, joining the New York, New Haven, and Hartford tracks. I imagine that the train would process to the junction, the center of West Concord. The engine would be turned around on the round table and would lay over for its return on the central division tracks down through Bow Street and Concord to Bedford, Lexington, Arlington, and finally Boston. Or proceed down the Fitchburg division tracks eastward to Boston. One could reach Concord Junction by more than one route from Boston. Back to Highland Street, running parallel up the street at a distance of about an eighth of a mile, were the Boston and Maine's Fitchburg division tracks. The land on the northerly side of the track, from the houses to the tracks, was owned by the West End Land Company. Whitney, Coal, and Grain occupied much of this land, and across the tracks was the Allen Chair Company. So, from our house on Highland Street, we had a sweeping view of the trains passing this stretch of the trackage. Supposedly, Highland Street was built on a ledge that stretched up to the Assabet River. So, when a train approached, the house would vibrate, the dishes would rattle in the china closet, and the swinging mirrors on the dressers would begin to move. One could detect that a train was coming from the west long before it could be heard. And lying in bed at night in the summer with the windows open, one could hear the steam engines chug, chug, chug all the way to South Acton and beyond. Just when you thought it was out of hearing, you would hear chug, 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 chug as the engine began its climb westward. The passing of a long freight train, sometimes 125 cars or more, would do either of two things. In the summertime, completely bring to an end any conversations, or at any time of the year lull you to sleep. Well, Highland Street was a shortcut for commuters from Upper Central and Main Streets. As the engine tooted its whistle at the Parker Street grade crossing in South Acton, late risers would start to jog their way to the depot. Margaret and Ann Coughlin, Elma Weatherby, Dorothy Garfield, and many others. Highland Street intersection with Church Street opposite Our Lady Help of Christians Church and the driveway to the West Concord and Harvey Wheeler Schools. But the West Concord School put the West Concord School on the missing list. But before we leave Highland Street, let me point out that there were three men who were employed there directly or indirectly by the railroad. One was Harry Myers, who was a station agent, Albert Hicks, the signal tower man, and Paul Barnes, agent for the Railway Express office in Old Concord. I might also mention that Burley Lincoln Pratt, coal dealer, Irving Linwood Bumford, automobile dealer, and Wells A. Hall, superintendent of schools in Concord, as well as John H. Adams, owner of Adams and Bridges, Dr. Isaiah Pickett, general practitioner, and my father, Robert W. Carter, all residents of this short street. Well, let's begin a short trip down to the depot. After passing Whitney Coal and Grain on the left, going down the hill, the road runs nearer to the railroad tracks where there was and still is a fence. However, the fence of the 20s and 30s was more like a farm fence than the present one, and one could command a good view of the freight activities. It was fascinating to watch the trains detach and shunt freight cars into a choice of several locations. After the airline to the brakes was disconnected with the sound of 100 champagne corks popping and the hissing of escaping air, the train man would uncouple the coupler. The engineer would start to move in the direction he wanted the freight car to travel, and the uncoupled car would start to roll towards its destination. The great thing was to watch the brakeman climb to the top of the car and manually stop the train by turning the big wheel at the top. The whole activity reminded me of the game Snap the Whip. As kids, we could watch for hours or until the train discharged its freight and picked up empty cars and went on its way.
Was the station master an important job?
Yes, mm-hmm. He was. I remember that as the train approached, he would come out into the waiting room and say, "Train for Boston," and then he'd go out onto the platform, and he always had papers to hand to a trainman or a conductor, and I suppose they were directions and his messages he had received on his telegraph, and he would pass that news on to whoever was in charge of the train. The other thing that I noticed, remembered very much, was the loading and the unloading of mail. The train probably would be delayed a few minutes if there was a lot of mail to unload. And of course, the fascinating thing was to watch express train go through, and with this sidearm sticking out of it as it went by, it would grab a bag of mail that had been placed in a certain spot for it to pick it up, and then it would come inside, and on their way to either Boston or to the West, the mailmen on the train would sort it so that they could throw it off at various stations as they went by. And it seems to me that delivery was much quicker than it is today.
I bet it was. The stations always had a Western Union telegram attached to it?
No, this one didn't, but it did have their own telegraph system. Mm-hmm. I think there was a Western Union station in Concord Center, but not in West Concord. Mm-hmm. But you see, they had messages coming in from the New Haven Railroad as well as the Boston and Maine, and I suppose that Central Division also had connected somehow. Of course, they were all connected by telephone, railroad telephone, too.
Okay.
One thing that I remember is standing out on the platform when an express train would go through, or a freight, and the amount of dust and debris that it would kick up, you'd have to turn away from it and protect your eyes, because you'd just get blinded by the debris, the sand and the papers and everything that just seemed to collect around the railroad station. But The other thing was meeting people at the railroad station. I can remember going to meet relatives who came to spend the weekend or the day or something, and how important it was to be able to be there on time when they arrived so that they know that they would be properly met.
Sure.
Going to Boston was always a great joy to me. Running on the, they used to call it the shopper's train, the 9:30. And when we get into the North Station, because the engines came practically up to the station itself, and you would walk by it and feel the heat of that steam engine and the smell of the warm metal, the hot metal and the hot oil that they used to lubricate the various connections on the train, you know. Everything had to work very well. So that's another childhood memory that also, amazingly, I think there were around 26 or 28 tracks in the North Station. And as you sat in your train waiting for the 5:14 to return to Concord, you'd watch other trains go out. And they all had to go through this rather narrow drawbridge area. And you wondered why they didn't collide. But mm-hmm. They were so, minutes apart, just like today, planes take off minutes apart and don't seem to collide. Well, trains used to do the same thing. So, anything else you'd like me to talk about? Let's see. I do remember that, of course, the development of stores, especially in West Concord, Concord Junction, were around the depot. The first new store was the West Concord supermarket. They built on railroad land that they were able to acquire from the Boston and Maine. The other building was also opposite the tracks. It was called the Bartolomeo Block. It's where Condon's liquor store is, and the Condon's now own that block. And then as you advanced up the hill towards Our Lady's Church, that stretch used to have a block of stores, a rooming house, and a fire station. And I guess everybody knows about the fire station burning down back in 1934, I think it was. And with the fire engines inside the firehouse, and I recall watching the boarding house. It was Mrs. Simpson's boarding house, and watching the bathtub fall from the second floor to the basement.
You don't forget that.
And George Simpson, who lived there, was mm-hmm. one of the early casualties of World War II. Another interesting thing was the next building to this, the block of stores that's now where the fish market is. It was Hogan's Spa, and they lost the third floor of their store in that fire. When they rebuilt it, it wasn't built as high as it had been previously. It still had an attic area, but it wasn't a full attic.
So we're on Church Street
on
now.
On Church mm-hmm. Street, right. And that's where all of us got penny candy and our 5-cent ice cream cone and our 10-cent soda or 15-cent sundae, I guess it's something in that range. But the penny candy was the big thing. I can see Mr. Hogan with his hands in his jacket pockets, jingling the change, hoping we'd make up our minds and get out quickly. So, let's see. The next building going towards Concord beyond Condon block was a restaurant owned by Mrs. Camo's mother and father, the Doucettes. And it was there in that restaurant that my folks first met the Collinses. They were new people in town, and they'd gone over to have their noonday meal, and that's where they met. So that was a place Mrs. Gamow told me that the trainmen from the B&M would gather there for their lunches, and they especially liked Mrs. Doucette's homemade apple pie.
And what is there now?
Let's see, the Gamows still live upstairs over it, and I think, what's under it? It's a store. It mm-hmm. keeps changing hands. I don't mm-hmm. know who's there right at the moment, but I think you'd recognize it. It's really just before you get to West Concord Supermarket, which is across
okay.
the street.
Mm-hmm.
So then, let's see, rounding the corner on Main Street, there was a small store where Mr. Blaisdell operated a jewelry store. That's where I bought my first Mickey Mouse watch. Then there was a little building which housed a fish store. And here my third grade teacher, Mildred, and she was nicknamed Tommy Bean Gale, would send me on an errand to pick up fish cakes. So the second building was another of those stores with living quarters above it. And this one was occupied by Jewett's Market, which later became Prendergast's Market. Across the street was Conant Machine and Steel Company's buildings, one of which was Mr. Tanner's blacksmith shop, and to the right was a hat manufacturer. A lot with a tennis court on it was next, going towards Maynard, which belonged to Harriet and Benjamin Shepherd. When my dad wanted to move from Adams and Bridges block across the tracks to a building of his own, the tennis court lot was the only available building lot in Concord at that time. Another did exist, but it belonged to Wild Bill Aldred, who wanted to sell out his auto repair shop and the land with it, but his wife would not release her dower rights. So after his death, she did sell it and hoped to Holly Holden and his mother. And that's where they occupied. That was across the tracks on Commonwealth Avenue. So another new building appeared in 1929 when my father built the building that Carter Furniture Company is in today. That takes care of pretty much of that area. The depot in West Concord was very important because of the manufacturing that took place in the town. The Allen Chair Company, they had their own little, what you call those side tracks that leave off the, depart from the main line and go right to your warehouse door. And so did Whitney Coal and Grain on the other side of the tracks. But other people shipped through that station. The reformatory shipped their things that they made in their furniture department. The Loring Brothers Lead Factory, the Blueing, who made the bluing for whitening clothes. The Garnett Shop Mill and the Webbing Factory, they all used that station for shipping across all over the United States, I imagine. Freight came in on the New York, New Haven, and Hartford, as well as the Boston and Maine, so there was an L-shaped warehouse. Some of it went up the towards Commonwealth Avenue, and the other was parallel with the tracks with the Boston and Maine track. And our freight, of course, arrived that way, too. After the New York, New Haven, and Hartford ceased operations as far as bringing in less than carload lots, we used to have to go to Framingham to pick up freight. And I mentioned a place to eat. There was a place to stay, too, a hotel. The Elmwood Hotel on Commonwealth Avenue was a residence for bachelor guards at the reformatory, as well as probably for other people in town who didn't have a home of their own. And the dining room was a very popular one, and they served very good food, I understand. And next to them, in the same building, The Roddys had a hardware store, and it, then also there was a pool hall in that building too, and further along there was a house where the Whitneys lived, Otis Whitney. It's the corner of Bradford Street and Commonwealth Avenue. It's occupied by Tony the Tailor at the moment. And beyond that was also the home of, let's see, what was his name? He gave, there's a picture of him down in the museum. Is it Hepford Wright? I think. Yeah, mm-hmm. He lived in the next house. So it was rather an interesting street for its time. I guess I rambled on long enough, but honestly, you can think of something that I left out that I should have spoken about. One interesting piece of news that kept appearing in the local newspapers was the fact that the American Woolen Company was going to open a branch in the Junction, and each issue of the paper would discuss that, well, plans were still underway, but nothing was certain, and finally the news came that they had abandoned the idea. But for quite a while it sounded like West Concord would have been another wool manufacturing town. I forgot to mention, I suppose, that the materials that went in and out of Damondale passed through the depot area too. I don't know if they had their own siding or not at up there at Damondale. Well,
thank you.
You're welcome.